Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Houston Lighting and Power Company versus Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railway Company from Galveston County. National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh versus CBI Industries from Harris County. And Fisk Electric Company versus Constructors and Associates, also from Harris County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 30 minutes for each side to present its arguments. The petitioners may reserve 20 minutes for each side to present its argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal argument by so advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument, and we will conclude these arguments before our noon break. The arguments are being recorded by the clerk for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to a tape of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Houston Lighting and Power versus Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe.
May it please the court, Mr. Paul Yetter will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, as the court will recall, the case involved a dispute over a contractual indemnity clause. The issue in this case, and the only issue in this case, is this. Whether the court's unanimous opinion in Ethel versus Daniel Construction applies to an indemnity clause that does not expressly cover the indemnity's own strict liability. In other words, or to put it somewhat differently, whether the courts of this state must follow Ethel in its holding that indemnity clauses are valid only to the extent they expressly state the party's intent to shift the risk and not apply an after-the-fact presumed intent standard. The court below did exactly that. The Texarkana Court of Appeals, following the urging of the Santa Fe Railway, created a presumed intent standard by which it held HLMP had presumably intended to cover the railroad's own strict liability. And I would quote from the opinion below. Quote, HLMP presumably realized that Santa Fe employees would use the Federal Employers Liability Act to recover damages for their injuries. The court went on to conclude below that it was not unreasonable for the trial court to construe the clause as covering Safety Appliance Act-based FELA claims. What the Texarkana Court of Appeals did, Your Honors, is reject Ethel and its express intent standard, distinguish and reject the court's holdings in Dorchester in 1986 and Rourke in 1975, which held that the same strict standard that applies to clauses that shift responsibility for negligence applies to clauses that shift responsibility for a party's strict liability. Your Honors, I have prepared remarks, but I want more than anything else today to address the court's concerns or questions or comments, and I would solicit them at this time. I'm certainly prepared to go forward, but if any of the justices have a question, I think we have tried to be as clear in our briefs as we can be, but if there is a question, I'd like to take it now so I can address it at the outset and make sure that I have enough time to satisfy whoever has the question.
Well, since you've asked, I'll ask.
Great, thank you.
You have, in your brief, you raised the analogy of strict liability to products liability. Is it well established in this state that for you to transfer the risk of liability into products liability, it has to be expressly stated?
Yes, it is well established, Justice. In 1975, an opinion authored by then Chief Justice Greenhill,
in the Rourke versus Garza case, it was a strict liability case, and the court specifically said that clauses shifting the risk for strict liability are outside the normal business practice, and thus fall within the same guidelines, and it was the clear and unequivocal test, thus fall within the same standards that indemnity clauses that shift liability for negligence are to be judged by. Now that holding in 1975 was reconfirmed by the court just before Ethel in 1986 in an opinion authored by Justice Gonzalez in the Dorchester case. The court said the very same thing, that shifting liability for an indemnity's own strict liability, in that case it was a product of defective product, is not the normal business, is not the usual business practice, and thus must satisfy the same strict standards that apply to contractual clauses that shift liability for negligence. I might point out, Justice Sinek, that the Court of Appeals below acknowledged that there is in Texas today a, what it calls the product defect or product liability, express product liability rule. But what the court did below is precisely what this court said in the ARCO case in 1989 courts cannot do. What it did was it carved up the general doctrine of strict liability. And I should say what the court did at the behest of the railroad was carve up the general doctrine of strict liability. And for most parties under the restatement section 402A, and specifically product liability, they must satisfy the standard of Ethel, the express intent standard. But for at least one class of litigants, and maybe only one class of litigants, and that is railroads, that have their own type of strict liability under the Safety Appliance Act, the court below said that they need not comply with the Ethel express intent standard. And in fact, it went beyond that. The court below said they need not express that intent to shift that strict liability under the Safety Appliance Act at all. They can be completely fine.
Couldn't you make the same argument, though, for a premises defect or a special defect or any other sort of thing that might otherwise be included in risk shifting in ordinary business practice? I mean, couldn't that argument really extend to that, you know, there's something about this operation, just there's a hole out there or something, and unless you expressly say we're going to transfer risk for premises defect, there's, I mean, don't all those arguments fit there?
Justice Haney, no, they don't. What the court has said so far is that when you want to shift responsibility for negligence, and it can be a premises liability sort of negligence for a landowner, because a landowner's liability is based in general on negligence, then you must expressly state that intent. If it is a strict liability risk that you'd like to shift to an indemnitor, under Dorchester and Rourke, you must specifically express that intent to shift it. What the court doesn't want to have happen, and what the court said in the ARCO case, is we're not going to require parties that enter indemnity contracts to decide between kinds or characters or degrees of negligence, or presumably of strict liability, or presumably of any other sort of basic kind of liability. So what parties to an indemnity contract need not do, I submit, is unless they decide between them that they want to, is specifically designate the kind, character, or degree of the risk that they're shifting. If they say negligence, then that is the risk that they shift, whether it is negligence based on premises liability or based on ordinary care or any other sort of negligence. The same with strict liability. The danger of what the Texarkana Court of Appeals did is take a type of liability, strict liability, acknowledge that most litigants must express their intent, but carve out an exception for one category of litigants, railroad. Did I answer your question?
We're getting it.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry.
The railroad makes two arguments. The first argument is that under the Safety Appliance Safety Act, or the Safety of Mines Act, FELA claims are negligence claims. So we don't have to resort to the presumed intent argument to sustain or to affirm the verdict of the Court of Appeals. What is your response?
My response, Justice Gonzalez, is the same as it was to the Texarkana Court of Appeals that rejected the railroad's argument below. A Safety Appliance Act violation is, according to the United States Supreme Court, more than 40 years ago, an absolute strict liability standard. And if I could quote from the O'Donnell case in 1949, early on the Supreme Court swept away all issues of negligence out of cases under the Safety Appliance Act. Now, I could go on I'll make one more comment, Justice Gonzalez, on that. What the Supreme Court did was, in this O'Donnell case in 1949, is address the uncertainty that had arisen because of loose language that some of the earlier courts, including the United States Supreme Court, had used in terms of negligence per se. But what the O'Donnell court did is recognize that negligence per se is too narrow a concept to protect railroad workers, and that under the Safety Appliance Act, a worker safety statute, that if you narrowed it to negligence per se, that doctrine only applies to injuries that the statute was designed to prevent. So if a worker is injured at the head of a train from couples that fail to couple at the rear of the train, that worker couldn't sue under the Safety Appliance Act because the Safety Appliance Act is designed to prevent men from going between the couples. What the court did is say, this is a strict, absolute liability test. And for 40 years, there's been no dispute in this court or in the United States Supreme Court. Now, I would like to make two comments on why the railroad struggles and persists in arguing that Safety Appliance Act liability is really some form of negligence. First, I think their effort is an implicit recognition of the weakness of their position under ETWAL. If the railroad can convince the court to inject some whiff of negligence into a Safety Appliance Act violation, then the railroad may have a chance of securing some sort of indemnity. I think they realize that if the court recognizes that the Safety Appliance Act is a strict liability standard, then their indemnity clause is defective. Second, I think that if this court were to inject negligence principles back into Safety Appliance Act violations, it would throw into disarray hundreds, if not thousands, of cases from today forward in which railroad workers sue under the Safety Appliance Act as a strict liability standard. And what the court will see, I predict, is the railroad and other railroads arguing to trial courts and to courts of appeal that the Safety Appliance Act, according to the Texas Supreme Court, is no longer a strict absolute liability statute, but in fact has negligence overtones. And I think that would be a significant and a very dangerous development, certainly not for the railroad, but for all of its employees. I hope I've answered your question.
Mr. Yetter, in your reply brief, you did not respond to reply point number two of the respondent about, I guess for lack of a word, the comparative percentage indemnity reduction.
That was an oversight, Chief Justice Phillips, and I apologize. I'm prepared to respond today if you'd like.
All right.
And your phrase is exactly on the mark. What the railroad is asking for is for the court to create a contractual comparative indemnity. In other words, what the railroad wants is, the railroad in this case was the only party, the only defendant, held liable for this accident that hurt its workers. And it was held liable both for it under the relaxed negligence standard under the FELA and for under the Safety Appliance Act, under the absolute strict liability under the Safety Appliance Act. What the railroad is now asking the court to do is to say,
that this clause will, even though the judgment is solely on the Safety Appliance Act, that this contract clause will give them indemnity to the extent that they were also negligent under the FVLA. Well, it is a novel but not new argument, Chief Justice Phillips, because the same argument was made in Ethel. In Ethel, once the indemnity realized it had lost because the new express intent standard was going to be adopted, it argued that, well, we should get contractual comparative indemnity to the extent that the indemnitor was also negligent. And I could... And if I could quote the court, Ethel next contends it is entitled to comparative indemnity to the extent of Daniel, the indemnitor's, negligence. The court concluded, however, the contract in question contains no provision for contractual comparative indemnity. Further, it says parties may contract for comparative indemnity so long as they comply with the express negligence doctrine set out herein. I would submit, Chief Justice, that the very same standard that the court embraced in Ethel applies here, that the railroad and any of its contracting parties can agree expressly to a contractual comparative indemnity. That was not the case here, and they're not entitled to the relief they seek in their reply point of error number one.
Any other questions? Any other statements?
If I would like to make a couple of the points with the court's indulgence. There are good policy reasons to justify rejecting the railroad's claim for indemnity, and I would say there are three at least. Two of them are specifically recognized by the court in Ethel. One is reducing indemnity litigation. This lawsuit is a direct result of the trial court and the Court of Appeals not enforcing the clear standards of Ethel. Ethel went that one step further to require the parties expressly to state, I'll address that on my closing.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Kenneth Bauer will present argument for the respondent.
I don't think the issue in this case is whether Ethel must be followed or whether Ethel is good law. The question is really twofold. Number one, does Ethel apply in this case? In other words, is an FVLA liability based on a Safety Appliance Act violation a type of negligence? If it is a type of negligence, then Ethel applies. And since the indemnity contract expressly mentions negligence and passes the express negligence test, then the indemnity award was proper. So to the extent that Ethel applies in this case, to the extent that it is relevant, the dispositive point is that the contract passed the express negligence test.
I understand a jury found that this coupler was defective. But isn't it possible that a coupler could get into the condition that it was in there with no negligence at all? I mean, these things adjust up and down?
Yes, that is very possible, and I think that is exactly what happened in this case.
And isn't that the difference between strict liability and negligence per se and negligence, which is strict liability? We don't care whether there's negligence or not. If that causes an injury, the person that has that instrumentality is liable.
That's essentially correct. to make sure we're saying the same thing, let me try to restate that. If the couplers are not aligned, and someone has to go between an alignment, then you have an SAA violation, and you have potential liability, irrespective of any issues of negligence. That's why the O'Donnell Court says the SAA rule sweeps negligence out of these cases. But there's two ways to characterize that. One way is to say you don't have to prove negligence. Another way is to say that the misalignment, as a matter of law, irrebuttably or conclusively establishes negligence.
But the misalignment could occur without any negligence at all.
It could occur without any negligence, and it could occur without anything being wrong with the couplers.
And as a result, the distinction here is that for to know whether or not this risk has been transferred, and it has to be expressed in terms of negligence so we know what's being transferred. But if the condition of the cover could be no negligence at all, then would a person know that the risk of an event caused by no negligence on anybody is also transferred?
I think so, particularly in this case. If I agree to indemnify you for any injuries arising from misaligned couplers that's due to your negligence, certainly I'm expecting to indemnify you if that happens and you're not negligent. And this gets straight to what I think is the real equity in this case. And I think maybe the best way to answer your question is to go back just a little bit over what happened. We've got two big companies that want to do business. HLMP wants the Santa Fe to deliver coal. Then HLMP builds a dumper, and they want the Santa Fe to deliver the coal to the dumper. And the Santa Fe says, all right, but we'll need indemnity for that. Now, what is the risk? What is the one thing, and this is in the record, what is the one thing that is certain to happen every time you pick up a coal car, flip it over, empty it out, flip it back and set it down? The one thing that's going to happen is that the coupler is going to fall off to a side. And then you're going to have misaligned couplers. And the railroad knows that when its employees have to manually align couplers, there is the potential for absolute liability. No one has to prove fault. And so the railroad says, we need an indemnity agreement, and HLMP makes this promise. They say to the railroad, we will indemnify you for any claims brought by your employees for any injury arising in any way from the use of this dumper. And we will do that even if you are negligent.
That's right. But the four corners of the agreement does not mention topside or bottom strict liability.
That's correct. It does not mention strict liability.
And if the Safety Appliance Act are based on a strict liability statute and there's no negligence on it, you lose.
No, sir.
If we hold the Safety Appliance Act is strict liability statute, how do you win?
There were two approaches to this. The first one was the one you just said, let's set aside. How we went on a second theory is the way the Texarkana Court of Appeals reasoned.
Presumed intent?
Not presumed intent. The point is that there is no requirement in this state or in any state that strict liability be expressly mentioned.
How about Dorchester?
There is a requirement. There is a clear and unequivocal rule, and I suppose it would become an express rule, that indemnity for the sale of unreasonably dangerous products must be expressly mentioned. But when we move from the sale of unreasonably dangerous products to misaligned couplers in an FBLA contract, we're making quite a jump. We have tried to make the point that strict liability is just a generic label for all kinds of claims, for all kinds of liability. Products liability, Section 402A liability, is merely one type. And the fact that we might have in this state an express products liability rule does not mean that every type of strict liability must also be expressly mentioned. So it's the jump from the sale of an unreasonably dangerous product to to a misaligned coupler for which the railroad bears the risk. That is the reason I say there is no express strict liability rule here or anywhere else. We're talking about a new rule. We're talking about
strict liability. The express rule is to guard against risks being transferred without focusing on it. When the liability arises under a statute that applies only to railroads, why doesn't that rule apply here?
Well, I think the answer is this. You have to stop somewhere. You can't express everything. When this court adopted the express negligence rule, they then faced questions from people that wanted out from under indemnity contracts about, well, don't you also have to say sole or concurring or gross or ordinary? And this court in the Atlantic Petroleum case said negligence will do. That's enough notice. In this context, how far are you going to go? All the precedent, all of the FELA indemnity contract cases that we could find have held that the word negligence in an FELA indemnity contract is enough to communicate the intent to indemnify for FELA liability. Now, the fact is there are different types of FELA liability. There's the ordinary negligence. There's a liability based on Safety Appliance Act violations. There's liability based on Boiler Inspection Act violations. If we say the indemnity agreement applies even if the railroad violates the Safety Appliance Act, is that going to be enough? What if it's a Boiler Inspection Act violation? There are a whole bunch of Safety Appliance Acts. Do you have to mention every single one?
What's your response to opposing counsel's suggestion that the benefit of expressing this in so many words is to avoid just this kind of litigation?
The point I'm trying to make right now is that if you create a new requirement and try to state it, you're going to invite new litigation.
Well, about all the details apparent, excuse me, counsel, won't it be rather apparent if you state it that it's covered and avoid litigation? And if it's unstated, then you'll have litigation over whether it's covered or not.
I have two answers. Number one, you could just as easily cut off litigation, and I think more cleanly cut off litigation, by holding that when the word negligence is used in an FELA indemnity contract, it covers FELA liability, whatever the source.
Without mentioning FELA?
Without mentioning FELA, it's always been the law. No dissent. It's a universal law as of today. The other answer to your question is, and this is the point I was trying to make with a different purpose before your question, but to direct it towards your question, how are you going to cut off litigation by requiring that something be expressly mentioned? What would that be? Now, I know that HLMP's position is that it doesn't really matter to us just as long as it's something that's not in this contract. But what are we going to have to say? And is it going to be enough? I talked about the fact there's all kinds of Safety Appliance Acts. There are also hundreds of regulations issued under these acts. And the trend seems to be that violation of those regulations will establish absolute liability, just like the general acts themselves. How far does a railroad have to go? Is strict liability going to be enough? Why can't HLMP come back another day and say, well, we know you said Safety Appliance Acts, but gosh, we weren't thinking of that Safety Appliance Act, or we weren't thinking of the regulations. How far do you go, and why do you want to go? Returning back to the facts of this case, the one risk that was involved was that of misaligned couplers when you flip the railroad car over. I have not discussed the precedents. They're all mentioned in the brief. No court in this country has ever had trouble with the notion that when someone agrees to indemnify a railroad against FELA claims, they are liable for FELA claims, whatever the basis for those claims is.
Counsel, what is your response to the argument that for 40 years or more, the U.S. Supreme Court held that the causes of action in the Safety Appliance Act are strict liability. They're not negligence.
This is the O'Donnell case they're talking about. And, I would rather talk about the Urey case issued 3 months before O'Donnell, but to answer your question about O'Donnell, this is a case where a plaintiff, an FELA plaintiff, lost at trial, and he appealed contending that there should have been a trial court instruction that misaligned couplers is negligence per se, and therefore, you know, no fact issue about negligence. And the Supreme Court agreed. It said, you're right, and we're going to reverse and remand for a new trial. But rather than use the words negligence per se, why don't you all just say that it establishes absolute liability irrespective of negligence? It's a semantic thing. And the reason the court said it was because in some parts of the country, negligence per se is understood to be rebuttable. In other parts of the country, it's not. What we have here is irrebuttable negligence. And the court thought this would be a better and less confusing way to explain it. But this same court 3 months earlier had said there's only one FBLA cause of action, and it's for negligence. And the violation of the Safety Appliance Act and the Boiler Inspection Act constitute negligence as a matter of law. You can look at it differently. It's almost a metaphysical thing. We all know what the facts are. When you have one of these violations, you don't have to present evidence of negligence.
Strict liability is strict liability, and the Supreme Court, you said strict liability.
It said everything possible. It said it's strict liability. It has said it is absolute liability. It has said it is negligence per se. It has used all of these terms interchangeably, as have all of the courts underneath the Supreme Court. And many of the courts have noted that these terms are used interchangeably, and yet when the precise issue in this case has come up, they've all come down in favor of the railroads. Did my time run out? Okay. Thank you. The leading cases, just to make sure you know what I'm referring to, are the Chicago Rock Island case, the Alva Coal case. Both of them are Seventh Circuit cases. The most recent case is the Illinois Central case, the Fifth Circuit case that came out in 1987. And I think it is fair to characterize all of these courts as holding that when an FVLA indemnity contract mentions negligence, it covers all forms of FVLA liability, including SAA-based liability. That is the holding of those cases. The implication is that the word negligence is enough, and that there is no reason or need to be more specific. That has been the universal rule up till today. The only possible source of discord would be the products liability cases in this state.
Counsel, if the state of the law is as you say it is, why would the Court of Appeal then have to resort to presume intent for its own?
The court said that HLMP is presumed to know the law. I think that's all it meant. Beyond that, the court said there is no express strict liability rule. Plain English applies in lieu of special rules that this court adopts, such as the express negligence rule or the express products liability rule. All claims means all claims. The court presumed that HLMP understood English. It presumed that HLMP understood the law. Those are fair presumptions. And this indemnity contract said HLMP will indemnify Santa Fe for all claims. Now, all ordinary rules of contract construction say that we will enforce the contract as it's written. There's nothing ambiguous about this contract, nothing ambiguous whatsoever.
So you say that you say the term all claims gets you over the hump, and an Ethel was unnecessary because all claims means all claims. And you don't have to have an express standard like an Ethel, because all claims, that clause, gets you over the hump, and that covers negligence, strict liability, and anything else.
No, sir. I'm saying there are two well-recognized exceptions to the idea that all claims means all claims. Ethel makes an exception with respect to negligence. Dorchester makes an exception with respect to the sale of unreasonably dangerous products. But apart from those two exceptions, ordinary English still governs, and all claims means all claims. To conclude on a few general policy questions, if this court's concern is the concern that was expressed in Ethel to eliminate litigation, to settle this for once and for all, then our suggestion is that you go with the rule that other courts have followed and hold that when an FBLA indemnity contract mentions negligence, it covers FBLA claims. It's a fair rule. The companies are presumed to know the law. There is only one FBLA cause of action, and it speaks of negligence. And it speaks of equipment failures. The alternative, it's not clear what it would be. What would the railroad have to say? And if you say, well, say strict liability, there's going to be more cases up before this court when we get into regulations. And, you know, strict liability is also a generic term. And there are a lot of specific things that fall under that category. So if you say that you have to expressly mention strict as a type of liability, then people are going to come forward and claim that you've got to go beyond that and expressly mention the types of things that are strict and on and on and on. Seems to me that the courts have wisely cut that off. And to hold that this contract should be interpreted in accord with what it says is not to violate Ethel, and it's not to violate Dorchester. If you choose to classify the kind of claim at issue here as a negligence claim, then Ethel applies. And the Ethel test was met. This contract complied with what Ethel required. If you don't choose to regard this as a negligence claim, but as a strict liability claim, then recall that there is no express strict liability rule unless this court is inclined to create one today. And that's going to be the source of further litigation. It's easier said than done, and there's no compelling reason to do that in the FBLA railroad employer-employee context. All things, all claims means all claims, with two exceptions. That's always been the law, and it should remain the law. If there's no further questions, that's all I have.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ken.
I have nothing further unless the court has a question or if I can be able to.
What about Chicago, Rock Island, and Illinois Central?
That case is not enough.
Cases.
I'm sorry, which maybe I didn't
Chicago, hear. Rock Island, and Illinois Central.
Illinois Central is out of the Fifth Circuit. That case never addresses the issue of whether Safety Appliance Act violations liability must be expressly stated within the four corners of the contract.
But it does uphold liability that's not.
Your Honor, it
would suggest that a liability could be upheld that's not.
What I would suggest, Your Honor, is the issue never arose. It's nowhere touched in the court's opinion. The court was focused on the causation aspect of whether the wood chip dumper was actually involved in the accident. In Chicago.
But it suggests that if it were liability, the indemnity agreement would be valid. But you're saying that they just didn't focus on express language.
Yes, just the fact. It's nowhere mentioned anywhere in that opinion that there was ever any Ethel issue in the case. And if you would like, I would certainly verify that was not in any of the briefs.
As I understand Mr. Bauer's argument, the only cause of action that can occur in the third sense of this case is one through the FELA, which is a negligence-based statute. And his argument is, yes, the Safety Compliance Act may be a strict liability statute, but only to the extent that it simply says, if under the FELA you claim that violation, then I have established liability as a matter of law. But without the FELA, the claimant had no claim against the railroad at all. Now, if HL&T and the railroad enter into a contract which clearly contemplates FELA claims, i.e., any negligence, irrespective of the determination of what the Safety Compliance Act says, strict liability or not, it can only be made applicable to the railroad through a negligence-based statute, and therefore, under the facts of this case, the risk has been transferred. I understand your whole issue is that all this strict liability is negligence, but if I understand Mr. Bauer's argument, well, that's not an argument we have to meet here, because the only way the railroad gets tagged is through the FELA, which is a negligence-based, and all the Safety Compliance Act does is just means the employee, when they're establishing a claim, just they don't have to prove liability.
I think the premise that he argues from, which is that the FELA is a negligence-based statute, is incorrect. I think what the United States Supreme Court has said very clearly is that suits under the Safety Compliance Act are strict liability suits. There's none of the defenses that you have to a negligence cause of action under the FELA. You don't have contributory negligence, you don't have assumption of the risk, nor do you have any aspect of not only do you not have those defenses, you don't have to prove that the railroad was negligent. So I think the very premise that he argues from is incorrect, Justice Ingalls. You also, I think the court also should be aware that this indemnity applies to a lot more than workers of the railroad. This indemnity simply says negligence, and what the railroad wants to say is, by saying negligence, as long as the indemnity contract is with the railroad, you've covered any sort of liability that the railroad could have to its own workers, or frankly, to anyone else. Again, we would disagree with that. In fact, we think that what the railroad is saying is precisely what Justice Gonzalez pointed out, is that all claims is enough, except if it's for negligence, and they've already said negligence. But any other nature of claim, strict liability, breach of contract, intentional torts, they're all covered because the railroad has said all claims. And I think at least what I, what I was hearing is the railroad wants the court to say, for railroads and railroads alone, all they have to say is negligence, and that is covered for any type of liability.
What degree of specificity are you arguing for? You're saying if this contract said strict liability that you would lose?
That's what the court has already said, Justice Cornett.
Is that what the defect that you said makes a difference in the outcome of this case and should decide the case in your favor, the omission of the word strict liability?
In the broadest sense, strict liability would cover.
What if the contract said for any claims arising out of the Safety Compliance Act?
If for this case, it would certainly cover.
Or the FELA?
Well, that's a good question. But I believe that in this case, that wouldn't cover, because they were held liable under the Safety Compliance Act, and the judgment was entered based on the Safety Compliance Act.
How about some generic phrase?
The generic phrase would be negligent and strict liability.
Any other type of cause of action that the law may now or hereafter recognize.
Counsel, what did... go ahead.
Is that the enough?
No, Chief Justice Phillips, I don't think that's enough. And the one court that we've seen that directly addressed it was the Corpus Christi Court in the McKesson case in 1982, and Justice Gonzalez was on the panel. In that case, the phrase was, for any liability or otherwise,
And what the indemnity was saying, well, when you have that broad, expansive, or otherwise, it's clear notice to the indemnitor that you're sweeping every sort of liability in. And what I think the very logical and correct holding was, that if you want to shift liability, you specify it. No one knows better than the railroad in this case what sort of liability it is potentially responsible for and that it would like to shift to the other contracting party. It is perfectly fair, and the court emphasized this in Ethel, to require the indemnity to tell specifically at the bargaining table the other party what it is shifting to it. And there's a lot of good reasons besides fairness. One is worker safety in this case. If the railroad can shift this liability without simply by using the phrase all claims, then the other contracting party really has no way to know that it is responsible for that and take steps to protect the workers out there. Justice Gammons, I'm sorry.
Never mind.
Any other questions? Thank you, Paul. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.